Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Laura Smith Biswas, a visionary co-founder of multiple healthcare startups. Laura blends the world of business acumen and holistic wellness. With an MBA from Yale, an MA in spiritual psychology, and expertise in plant medicine and health education, Laura represents the intersection of conscious business and healthcare innovation. She embarked on her entrepreneurial journey in 2008 after honing her skills in the biopharma industry. Laura's leadership at Cadence Communication and Research, Sequence, and the Love Mandala have been instrumental in creating businesses that not only thrive financially, but also contribute positively to global well-being. Laura is committed to creating win solutions for all stakeholders involved. I've asked her to join us here today to share her story, insights on creating culture in companies, and the future of business and medicine. So Laura, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
Good. That's a lovely introduction, Daryl. Thanks for having me. Really, it's really a pleasure to join you and connect with your community and see if I can be of help in any way.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you here. And I always like to ask, before we get into running multiple businesses, creating a culture, navigating the ups and downs of economies, how did you even come to being an entrepreneur? Is this something that you, are you blazing a new trail? Do you come from a family of entrepreneurs?
Yeah, it's such a good question, right? Because I think there is a little bit of a, I don't want to say a type, sometimes it does run in families or in circles, right? Or because it takes a certain risk appetite to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And I would say that I never would have expected I would have taken this route because I didn't have that early on in my life. I didn't have that risk appetite. But what happened for me is as I grew up and there weren't a bunch of entrepreneurs in my family, although this generation, I have siblings that took the same route. A bunch of us decided to start that within our family, but I didn't come up that way. And what happened for me was after getting into corporate America, after I went to business school, like I was just like, oh, I want to make a difference somewhere. So I picked healthcare. I was always interested in it. I had done health education as an undergrad. And as I got into it, I really was learning a lot. And I was working for Fortune 50 companies. These are some of the biggest companies in the world in that space. And there, I had some really good mentors, which I was very fortunate because you never know in a given job if you're going to get a great boss or not. And I was lucky also to have some women that were great bosses of mine. So I saw women in good leadership positions, which I think there's a little bit more of that in healthcare than I saw with some of my peers in other industries like finance and such. And so that was a great starting point for me. So I was learning a lot until I got maybe, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 years into my career. And then I just hit a wall where I was just not interested in anymore. And I couldn't make myself pretend that I was. It was almost like waking up one day. And I think I had just changed and realized I wanted something more out of my work life. It wasn't very balanced. So I had three little kids at the time. And they were getting very little attention and they were great kids and I wanted to spend more time with them, but my life did not really allow. It's like in my last job in corporate America, I was an investor relations officer. So I was going to New York from the West Coast and things like that and really spending time in the office and trying to figure out like how to get some work-life balance. And it wasn't really happening. But I was getting great training, but I hit a point where I said, okay, this is not really working for my own life, even though it's got some perks. There's compensation. There are good things about it. But I think I had just realized like as a whole person, this isn't really supporting me in my whole life. And so I took some time off and I went back and got my master's in spiritual psychology. And I really took time to go, what do I want to do? And I started, honestly, I did a little bit of just experimentation. Like I first did some financial consulting with small businesses and I didn't really love that much. And then I started a grief recovery startup that was a digital solution online to help people remember their loved ones. And I actually was really into this whole project and it was a really beautiful digital solution. I invested money in it, had programmers developing something, and then I got cancer. And I honestly couldn't finish creating it. And when I came back to it and I was lucky enough to get a cancer that's curable, like by most measures, I had thyroid cancer, but it really took me out for a while. I had to have surgery, radiation. I had little kids and it was a very serious thing. And when I came back, the market had moved and the digital solution didn't make sense anymore. And so I had to basically scrap this thing I'd worked on for a couple of years that I was really emotionally invested in. And
Yeah.
so that was my first like heartache and as being an entrepreneur, I guess that everybody goes through those, I think.
Well, it's your baby, right?
It was, yeah. So it was the first baby that didn't really get off the ground. And then so this is a bit of a story too, but I was married at the time with somebody who wanted to be an entrepreneur as well. And so we ended up starting a business called Cadence that we still run today, although we're not married anymore. So we went through a divorce while running a company and midway through. And so that alone is quite an interesting story that we navigated it. We're still really good friends. We still work well together. But at the time, it was like, look, we both have the skills to do this. Let's just try it. Let's go for it. And you never know. There's no perfect time, right? It's a difficult decision, but there was just a point where it was like, okay, let's give it a try. And we started during the recession in 08. So it was not really ideal. So it was a touch and go kind of thing. And I don't want to say touch and go. It was just like any small business in the beginning. You're like, do we have enough cash to keep everything rolling, even though the projects are coming in, but you don't always get paid when you do the work. And that's true in our industry. So that was an exciting journey starting from like ground zero, because I really only worked for huge companies. So I had so much to learn. And that in part is a great thing about being an entrepreneur, is it just invites you to learn over and over, because whatever size you get to, and then you grow to the next, you got to learn something new to be successful.
100%. And even if you're not growing, your competitors are going to take you out. So it's not like a career where, forgive me, but if my brother's a carpenter and I'm sure there's advancements in carpentry, but I don't know if it's like what journalism and the writing industry or the music industry have experienced in the last 10, 15 years in terms of disruptive technology and innovation. So if you have a business, you compete with everybody else out there. I want to bring it back. I want to ask your advice, and it leans into what you're saying. You talked about how you had to walk away from your baby, and it reminded me, I thought of something that's a really important point, is that for people to fall in love with markets, not products or services, because of exactly what we talked about here. Things change, either because your company's getting bigger and so what you're doing is changing, or the industry is changing, or a competitor is doing something different now and now you have to respond somehow. And so you can't necessarily fall in love with your product or service. What you really need to do is fall in love with your market. Can you speak to that a little bit? Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but has that been a bit of a guiding light to be able to run multiple companies?
I think it's funny, in retrospect, I can see that's what's been happening for me. I don't think I knew it at the beginning, but the thing is, you're like, I'm a big believer that you have an innate compass. If you're really listening to yourself, yourself will draw you into things. You'll be attracted to this, you'll be interested in that. And so it brought me through that. And in some ways, if I put all the pieces of what I've done together, they all have a common thread of either clients or patients in the healthcare system that I'm trying to help them have a better, experience from a holistic perspective. And everything I've done has something to do with that. So there is a thread, even if maybe somebody outside wouldn't have seen it. But I do have a lot of passion for people going through either a recovery, whether it's a health or a growth process in their life, and going through transformation, because that's something that I, unfortunately, because my own life, I'd been through so many times that I came to know that journey really well and understood how to help people navigate it. And I just wanted to play in that it somewhere.
You're basically catering to yourself, it sounds like, people that were going through the same or similar. Is that?
Yeah, and there's whether it's and it is interesting. This wasn't conscious, but the Cadence business, which has been around, is the biggest one I've built, which has been around 15 years. I think we're going to 16. We were really heavy focused on oncology, and that sort of happened over time. We do rare disease work, we do other kinds of work as well. And my interest has always been like, how do we affect the patient to have a better experience and not just support the scientific, but my interest has gradually kept shifting towards what about the other parts of that experience, the emotional experience, the psychological experience, because I've been there, and I've also been through. I had a father who died of a brain tumor very young, so I've walked on that side of it. Life has a way of preparing you for knowing where your lane is when you want to help other people. Where can you really contribute the most, along with your education and your skill set, all those things. So that's certainly been the case for me, and so I can really appreciate that perspective, because you absolutely. I'll tell you another one. One of the ventures that I have that's still going, and we've shifted our strategy because it really changed as the market changed, was as we went into the pandemic, we had a lot of scientists on staff and on Cadence. And people started to have extra time. We just, our clients weren't doing a lot of business. We weren't going to lay everybody off. We were lucky enough to have PPP money coming through to support the transition. So we were like, look, we've got an opportunity to do whatever we want and create something. And so we looked around and we said, like, where can we bring this medical communications expertise we have? And we reside, our headquarters anyways, in California, where there was a really big shift going on with cannabis becoming both a medicinal and a recreational product. And it'd been around for a little bit. It's not like it was totally brand new, but it was really booming. In fact, the office next to us was a CBD company. So we got talking to them and we became interested in using that expertise to try to communicate where's the most accurate information and where can we find the substantiated studies around using cannabis as a medicine and to help get that information out to the marketplace. Right. And so because there are amazing uses of it, and there's also a lot of misinformation out there and a lot of a fear about it too. And right. So we worked on a whole solution around that and creating a video education platform that we basically prepared to help people get the right information in that marketplace. And we're still trying to figure out the right vehicle. And we think we've figured that out. We're looking for a partner now. But that was a whole journey because we were super excited about it. And we thought we could just go out and sell it to brands. And their focus is just a little different. Like, they have so much on their plate just to deliver product to the market and make new SKUs. And the market was not that lucrative for people because there's incredible price competition going on. Like, people were selling stuff below cost. And so people really didn't have budgets to do the kind of thing we thought would assist them. And so it's been a really interesting journey. But once again, the general impulse to just want to bring something to the market to help people get the best information to have a better quality of life, a better health experience is still there. Yeah. And that I haven't lost sight of. And we still got our strategy to bring that to fruition.
I love that. Yeah, you reminded me of a famous, I don't know if it's a quote, but just a thought that I got from Greg Glassman, the founder of CrossFit. And he talked about how markets are ultimately unknown and unknowable. Like, in the sense of, if I ask how many people are in market to buy a car today or a Tesla, you can tell me lagging leading indicators, but ultimately we don't know the true value and it's constantly in flux. But everybody can acknowledge excellence. So if you're really clear on the problem you solve and who you solve it for, and you focus on being excellent at that, that could be a good guiding light, that it's visible to everybody. And that just making money on its own can be a short. So many companies talk about corporate. They're so focused on this quarter, but you don't want to throw the baby with the bathwater. You don't want to burn your relationship. You know, another guest, Brian Kurtz, he ran $40 to $100 million company. And one of the things he said is, not everything is a sales event, but everything is a relationship event.
And I totally agree.
And so what would be some of your advice you would give someone who's either starting out in business or struggling?
I wouldn't go very far from what he's saying, but I'm going to tweak the relationship message a little bit. I think everything in business, at least my experience has been that it really just boil down to relationships, whether you're building an online relationship with somebody or it's a true partnership or you're meeting in person or you're collaborating on something. Everything goes back to relationship. And the piece that people are less aware of, although I think a lot of entrepreneurs know this by experience, whether they would articulate it this way or not, is that your relationship with yourself is this foundational piece to building whatever you're building, right? Whether it's a company, a product, a service. And so I'm a really big advocate of making sure that people keep an eye on the inner work of how they're relating to themselves. And are they building things on a foundation where they can navigate as an entrepreneur with stability? Because there are going to be ups and downs. Like, in the healthcare market, for example, with Cadence, we got to this one point. We'd been on the Inc. 500 list a couple times. We're just growing like crazy. We're super excited. And our biggest client was bought up by a pharma company that is not well respected in the industry, that just basically fired everyone, stop promoting the products, jack prices. They're the epitome of what people think of, unfortunately, the negative viewpoints. There's lots of good ones out there too. So I don't think everyone's like that, but we were the recipient of losing our biggest customer like that. And all those people eventually found jobs and called us back, but we lost a huge portion of business overnight. And it was just like, okay, we didn't do anything wrong, but right. you could go into deep self-flagellation and upset and everything around. I think we're going to have to do some restructuring. You might have layoffs. We had to do so many things to navigate that because of our size and the concentration we had with them. And we knew we were concentrated, but like all companies, as you're growing, you never turn down good business that's coming to you. Right. And when you do a great job, your customers often get bigger, and it's tricky, right? It's not
I think
so there's inner work around just navigating that change, for example, and like having support with that is really powerful, and putting something in place so that you're not just going in and riding the waves without support, I think, because otherwise it can be really challenging emotionally.
Yes, I agree 100%. I always felt early in my career, I felt that business was very Shakespearean, where a lot of businesses failed. In all of Shakespeare's plays, the tragedy built around the main character flaw of the primary characters. And I feel like business is that way as well. And in 2020, I think I talked about this before in our meeting group before we did the interview, but I did a bunch of research, had 10 assistants help me go through all the academic literature we could find on business success. And we uncovered 8 critical success factors for small and medium-sized businesses. And people sometimes ask me, what's the one factor to rule them all, right? People want the magic bullet. There is no magic bullet. But if I had to pick one to excel at, it's self-efficacy, which for us, when we went into the research, we defined it as certain personality traits, certain leadership skills, and personal disciplines. The personality traits were things like locus of control, which means being a control freak about the things you can control, extroversion, openness to experience, agreeableness, conscientiousness, acceptance of criticism and feedback. So you have to be able to handle that. Otherwise, you can't fully adapt. And that was under leadership skills. For us, the leadership skills were self-awareness skills, communication, cooperation skills, emotional intelligence skills, and adaptability. And how many people do we know that they have a business, but they treat their customers like crap or their staff? Or I've had people come and try to have me as a client because they had staff leave and sabotage things on the way out. And that's where they weren't agreeable. They weren't conscientious. They didn't have good emotional intelligence. They just didn't handle that. And then of course the personal disciplines, personal mental disciplines, time management, the willingness to commit, things like that. So I agree 100% with what you're saying, that if you aren't taking care of yourself, you are the foundation everything is built upon.
Yeah, and it's hard to say. I love you saying that there isn't one thing, because there isn't, right? You have to do the fundamentals. And I didn't go to business school at Yale and then ignore that your operations need to be efficient and your finances need to make a profit. And you got to keep an eye on your staff utilization or whatever it is that matters to your business. I'm saying that knowing that, yeah, your basic strategy, your basic operations, all that stuff has to be there too. But people know that. It's okay, but what beyond that? Like, where do we sometimes miss the mark? There's a lot of things that mattered. And it's a little bit like, can you juggle a lot of balls without being too wrapped up in not being able to keep them all going at all given times and just keep picking them up and going again, if that's a good analogy.
You keep moving forward while taking bullets to various body parts. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What would be some of the skills or behaviors that you think are important?
So let's talk about, because hiring great people, let's just say, because there's lots of right people, but hiring great people into your organization is one of the other most profound things you can do. And looking for those traits that really demonstrate that they're a good fit, both strategically, skill-wise, and culturally, those things all matter. And do they play well in the sandbox? And I say that in part because, let me back up and give you like a little bit of a framework I've been using lately that I found really useful that tells me why you need all those elements. I was in a wonderful training from the Online Exchange Group, and they have this triangle transformation they use where they say you can unlock value in any organization or group in 3 ways. And the first way is through intellectual capital. So that means doing things like, can you unlock more creativity? Can you unlock more active learning in your organization? Can you, for us, for my business, the Cadence one, I would say, can I unlock more scientific knowledge from my staff and expertise and bring it to the marketplace? The second area of unlocking value is what they call communal capital. And so that's when you have shared purpose in your group. And I think of this, when I translate it to my world, I think of that as the company itself. Are we nurturing what's important? Do people feel they belong? Do they feel a sense of purpose together? Because if they do, they're going to behave very differently. And do they feel connection with each other? And do we feel like a team? And this is why, again, picking people that know how to lead and to build teams and those kind of things in an effective way matter. And then the other thing that the triangle of transformation is based on is social capital. So that's a third piece. And this is bigger. This is, in my world, I would call that, what's the social capital? It's like the patients, the medical system, our clients, our vendors. And it's like, how can we unlock more value with them? And that means that we've got to have more than one-way communication. We have to learn to build relationship. We have to really network and connect with them and make sure we understand them really so that all of these pieces of having an impact can be unlocked. So when I look for people and I look for people that will really contribute to this, I'm looking for people in our area in healthcare. They have to be really, they just have to have the depth. It's a really complicated market. If you don't know anything about payers or how the healthcare system works or how manufacturers buy a product and sell it, and you want to be in the biotech, you better go learn that because you can't get by. So it's okay if you don't know in the beginning, but you just have to learn everything, even if it's not your area, in order to get really solid. But once you have that, it's, I'm looking for, okay, are people really creative? Are they, do they have an openness to try things? Like in a smaller company, people get asked to do all kinds of things you wouldn't do if you're in a big company with a siloed job. And so I might go to you and be like, can you come up with an idea about how we can do this? And can they think out of the box? Are they willing to try stuff? And one of the things I've noticed, we had a really good hire come on recently and last year. And one thing I really liked about her is she had really good, healthy boundaries because now everybody works from home. So one thing I really liked about her, so as the CEO, I asked her for a meeting one time and she said, I've got that block to do this work because I got a deadline. I could really meet you at this time or this time. So instead of just throwing everything out the window and being like, oh, yeah, Laura asked me to meet with her, I better just do whatever she says. She gave me her structure and I thought, love it. I think that's great. Like, I respect how you're operating because she's staying focused and she's really knows how to initiate and manage her time and deliver results. And so all the people, honestly, everybody in the company that I've got that works for me and the rest of our team, they are really committed to high service. So that's, they care that the client gets a great output and we do whatever we can to meet that without, and I don't mean sacrifice yourself in some way that is detrimental to your own health or something, but right, we do whatever we can within reason to meet our clients and make a partnership where they're like, you make my life easier. I'm going to want to keep working with you. And it's genuine.
So how do you develop that culture? Do you have any tips on building culture in a company? Because culture is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, it really is. And I heard a good saying, I think it was yesterday, that I really agree with. Somebody said, if you have it doesn't matter how good your company is, how good your services or your products or your process, but if you have a toxic culture, it's gonna have an impact.
Oh yeah.
And there's no way around it. And likewise, when you have a great one, it's not gonna resolve if you like have a mismatch with the marketplace. But if you have both, can you imagine what you can do? Right. So there's so much energy spent when you have even one person that is not really healthy mentally, yes, and who is causing havoc in teams and stuff. So that's one thing I've learned is to get people coaching very quickly. And if they don't respond to it, then I really can see the writing on the wall that they're not a good fit for the organization. And often people like that, they even end up leaving themselves. I don't know. It's just sometimes works like that. We've had to tell people like, this isn't just working out sometimes. But when you do have, so part of it is really sifting through your staff, because sometimes you do make mistakes hiring and you just got to admit it and go, okay, this person isn't fitting. There's a lot of gossiping going on, or they're not taking feedback. They're not learning from it. They're finger pointing, those kind of things. They're not productive. And
you almost need to hire for the soft skills.
Yeah.
You can train, you can train up. I remember we did this activity when I had a martial arts school. I was doing a martial arts, like how to run a martial arts school. And one of the things that they asked, because there's a lot of people that had, let's say maybe imposter syndrome a bit, because they weren't world champions type thing. And then they were like, okay, let's say you were going to have the world's greatest coach. What would that coach be like? And make a list of 5, 10, 15 attributes. And they listed them, we'd list them all down. This is us as a group doing it. And I was like, okay, which one of those are binary? Either you have it or don't. and which ones can be developed. And so all of a sudden on this list of 10 items, like we're like eight of these are things that I can improve on. Like it's character driven. And yeah. I've hired multiple world champions I did training camps with guys like the Mendez brothers. If anyone's a jiu-jitsu know, these guys won everything they entered for years. And the Mendez brothers were great. I'm not throwing them under a bus, but some others that I got, they were amazing competitors, terrible coaches. They're like, just do it. And you're like, okay, but how? They're like, you just do it. Like they couldn't articulate. And so it sounds like you really have to watch the interpersonal relationships and even the mindset of some of the people. And of course you can have support systems in place, but at some point you have to perhaps have predetermined lines drawn in the sand. I know for my team, we do a weekly 3 key metrics thing, which every team, or if one team's big, maybe we treat them as a department, but we have 3 key metrics and they can be tangible or intangible. But if they're intangible, we have to define what success looks like as a 10 and define what success looks like as a 0. And then in the weekly kind of huddle, each like one-on-ones and that, they give a score, and the manager, or if I'm doing it, I give a score, and then we take the middle. And like you mentioned, when people know they're not meeting, we're like, the benchmark is 8.5. Like we got to try and stay at 8.5. People aren't able to meet that. They know to opt out. And anyways.
Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah. And it's one of those things where the thing is, it really does matter that the leadership is living it. It's true that culture is not static. So like we have a list of values that we talk about and revisit, but we tell people from day one, these might change next time we look at them. Like it might be that this one becomes less important and something else rises to the top, because it's a living system. And it's just silly to act like it's going to be perfect all the time. You either get it. It's not binary. Okay. It's a continuum. Mm. So your culture continuum, like you just have to keep moving it towards that healthier place, and you've got to demonstrate what that means. And so we've chosen as a leadership team to be more transparent than most companies our size about what's going on. We've chosen to talk about things openly when even sometimes we don't know the solution to stuff. It's, we know that people are concerned about this. Let's talk about how people are, you know, processing. Mm. Even in the pandemic, we talked about what was happening in the news at some of our meetings. And we just really try to create a situation where it's not ego-driven. So one of the things I really like, and I always say this in front of the whole staff, like one of my PhDs, when he first came on, he's just in a meeting and there was people at all levels in this meeting with a whole bunch of doctors. And some doctor was like, can somebody grab me a coffee at the Starbucks in the building? And he jumped up and went and got it instead of looking to somebody that was more junior than him. And that's just the kind of place that everybody, now, of course, sometimes like that person needs to be in the conversation. They shouldn't go grab the coffee. He's smart enough to know the difference. And it's just, he set a precedent that there's no hierarchy. It's about like creating an environment where we're all in this together and delivering what's best for the people that are in the room, and we're trying to really assist. So it's a simple story. We had one of our other leaders who just went out of her way to help a patient that was in one of our meetings who was on a flight with her, and his wife was at home bedridden, and he was not going to be able to make it home because of the weather situation. And this person literally wasn't going to have care and was going to be stuck in bed, not able to get up, go to the bathroom or anything. And so she got on it. She talked to the pilot. She tried to get the pilot to divert the plane that she went. She couldn't do that. They actually called the airport. They tried to do, the pilot was actually receptive, but they couldn't do it. So then she got on and she basically helped this guy find a backup provider to go to his house. So when he got home, his wife wasn't in distress, and she didn't need to do that. But like that ended up circling back to our client who this was like a patient advocacy board that he came to. And she didn't do it for the client accolades, sure. But can you imagine how happy they were that she did that? Sure. So that's service orientation. Like you could train people, but they have to be receptive to training to come in with that kind of a commitment to delivering a great environment.
I love that. Now, over your career, obviously, you've most likely had other friends with businesses and obviously done business with lots of businesses. What are some of the greatest mistakes that you see your clients and other entrepreneurs making? We've talked about some, but to really hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I think the thing is when people are really short-sighted and choose from fear. And that translates to a lot of things. But when I'll take even go back to like when I was in investor relations, this idea that so much of our market is focused on short-term earnings and not long-term value, I think it's just a little disservice to the whole marketplace, because people make investments and decisions in businesses to play the game with the investors and to try to hit numbers and all. There's just a whole thing going on in the whole marketplace like that, where, but they're not always making the decision that's wisest for the customer, for the long-term longevity of the health of the business, because of that really short-term focus sometimes. And I'm obviously not going to affect that, but that's my view on the capital markets.
Because, I mean, we all know the story. Would you take $1 million or a penny a day doubled for 30 days? And everybody, if you haven't heard of that, it's like a penny, the $1 million up front is the best deal until something like day 26. And all of a sudden, and I don't know the math, I'm making this up, but all of a sudden it's like day 26, it's $1.5 million. And then it's 3 million, and then it's 7. So if you just took the $1 million, you would have missed out on something like an extra $10 million if you had doubled. And that's compound. Yeah. And compounding only works over a long term. So what you're saying is, I love it, because I feel like even if you don't have an ethical bone in your body, the only way to do business is with love. You have to love on your customers, your clients, your staff.
Your market, a
great example of this is if you put something truly excellent out into the world, like people want it and they love it and they share it. But especially in today's transparent era, if you're losing customers because you have a terrible product or service, for every customer you lose, you have to get two more, but not just two more in terms of sales, but you also may or may not realize, but as you scale up, it's like a percentage where a certain percentage of your customers are disgruntled. And so as you grow, that disgruntled group grows as well. And so the best thing you can do is try to love on everyone and treat everyone and make sure everyone is happy and kill your ego. I thought that was a great comment.
Yeah, and I'll give you another way of looking at it too, is all relationships, whether they're business partnerships or they're personal, family, friends, romantic, whatever, they're all acting often as a mirror for us. So they show us the places that we need to do our work. And
love that.
And so you'll know, you'll feel it, you'll see, like, I'm having continual conflicts in the same area, whether it's with, if you pay attention, you will, instead of blaming people, if you look, you'll say, oh, I seem to have a wound because I always feel pricked by this particular thing that happens. Yes. And then I often overreact. And so then you can go, okay, I need to do some work there, instead of fighting with a client or trying to say this was a bad vendor. And some relationships aren't respectful enough to continue. Sometimes you have to walk away from stuff, but generally, the work is inside. It's not in trying to force people to see things your way or those things. And fear has this way of driving people to decisions that just don't make sense long term. And so if you can detect that you're operating from fear, then you're probably making not the wisest choice. So learning to care for that and I'll say this, even with your ego, I've begun to think not so much get rid of my ego, but to transform it into a partner, to a friend that works with me instead of against me. And so the same with your fear. If you think your fear is basically telling you someplace where you have a misunderstanding because you're so afraid that, or sometimes it's just pointing you where you need to take care of things. Like maybe your finances are taking a dive and you're afraid and you're like, okay, I need to deal with this. Let's not put our head in the sands. Let's work on it as soon as possible. Right. But oftentimes we have fear that's just, we're just afraid of some future or past thing that isn't happening, and it's driving behavior that's not for the best. And so looking at really embracing it as an aspect of ourselves and saying, okay, can I approach this part of me and say, is there anything to learn? What can you tell me? Like, why are you present within me? And embracing it in a way, almost like you would a little kid. If you have a child, you have a niece or nephew that you can relate to that. And say, I know there's a lot going on here. What is it? What's the truth underneath all this sort of emotion?
Yeah.
And then you can transform to that wiser part of yourself that knows, okay, if I calm this fear or I take care of it and put it in a place of love, then I can see where to go, even in difficult situations. So I've been in some pretty difficult situations with any business owner. But when you get back to that, like the path is clear, your vision is totally different. And then you can see solutions. You totally miss them when you're anxious and we let stress override.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. It's hard to be creative when you're afraid at the same time. Creative energy can't coexist with fear and terror. And so I also think that part of a solution, there's two things what you said made me think of that I think might be helpful for listeners. And one is try to imagine what life would look like once it's solved and then reverse engineer how you got there. But the other one is to try to look for help. If you have a sincere intent and genuine desire to serve and to help others, if you were a soldier trying to protect a family, trying to protect a community from raiders, from the bandits, and you got injured and you needed help to climb the wall, there's no shame in that to say, hey, I need help. Help me over this wall. Because your goal is holy, so to speak. I don't know why I tiptoed around that, but you have a higher purpose that of good intent to serve the world. You're giving of yourself to the betterment of our species and of your people. And so there's no shame. And that's also, I think that can help get rid of fear. Again, I'm spiritual, not religious, but I love this quote. It's from, I grew up on Tupac, but he says, how could the devil hurt my brother if he's close to me? And I think that's really powerful. Whereas if you have strong ties, strong networks, and you're feeling fear, you can ask for help. And that helps, like venting works, like emotion, energy, emotion.
Yeah.
You have people you can share that with. The fear is gone. Now you come back to a creative space and you create your way out of it. That's what we are. We are creators. We are knowledge creators. And I think that's a really powerful message.
I totally agree. And in fact, I think, Daryl, I actually think there's been a call in the world to do business very differently.
Yes.
And it's people like you that are in that vein, and hopefully people see me in that vein too. I think there's a new paradigm trying to be born, and I'll give you some examples of what I think is trying to change. We live in a world, and especially because now people are cognizant of global warming and all the problems have been created, we have to move from greed and scarcity to solutions for everybody. Like, businesses need to be thinking about a solution that is good for everything. It's good for the earth. It's good for the client customers. It's good for the people that work there, and nobody's being thrown under the bus.
Yeah.
Another one is like moving from like me and them thinking to inclusion. And you can put diversity and service in that too, but really thinking about things differently instead of just strict competition and an us and them kind of thing. A third way I think about it is self-interest only or isolation to much more unified interest and connection with people. People don't resonate with this sort of one-way energy. Like, people really resonate with connection, and everybody, if social media has taught us anything, it's taught us how important connection is, and authentic connection, not superficial.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a starvation for that. There's also just moving from cynicism to creativity is another way I think about it, or disillusionment to discernment. Like, when you see things that aren't working or people doing things away in business that you don't respect, okay, so instead of just being disillusioned, be somebody who's a creator that says, okay, I'm going to discern and figure out how to do this differently and better, rather than just throwing up your hands, because that will not create a better world for all of us.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think people are just sick of being taken advantage of, the profiteering, the lies. There was Assange, the journalist. He said that one of the things that he learned from WikiLeaks was that people don't like wars, and almost all wars that we've had in modern history are due to lies that were perpetuated by the media. And it's this underbelly of, like you mentioned, greed, fear, profiteering. I love how you put it as one-way energy. People are just sick of it. I'm sick of it. People are sick of it. That with things like, it's transparency and authenticity. The whole hang up a shingle to celebrate Black History Month when you're running slave shops in Africa. Like, the people just are so sick and tired of that.
Yeah.
My research even showed that. So I told you about the 8 factors. Under marketing strategy, we found the pillars of marketing, a successful marketing strategy, are good market intelligence, product characteristics, the quality and fit, intense advertising and networking, and then a scientific method, testing. But the two that have related to this is brand integrity and trustworthiness and corporate social responsibility, not ESG, which is Trojan horse political agendas, but community development, ethical values, and conformity to legal processes. That is positively correlated to success in marketing. Brand integrity and trustworthiness is transparency, customer-focused USP, authenticity, brand consistency, and clear brand purpose and promise. And it just comes back to this, that people want it. We want win relationships. We want sustainable economies and ecosystems. And I love how technology has brought us to a world where I don't necessarily know if things are getting worse. I think it's just more is coming to light. And light
I
is
agree.
disinfectant and it's painful, but
Yep.
I love that.
And you know what? People are, I think this is not exactly like my focus for work, but I, because I have a young adult children, I feel like people in the next generation are like, some of them are really activated and changing the world already, but there are many of them that just need the invitation to be engaged to solve the problems that exist in society and know that they're part of the solution. And we've been in a world that was top down, command and control. Nobody wants to work like that. And they've, I think they've said, their generation has said, we're not going to, so many of them are entrepreneurs, or they're just, there's a lot of kids that just opt out of working or at home because they don't want to operate in the old world, but they don't know where to go.
Yeah.
And so creating businesses where we solicit and engage people and we make it a true partnership and we try to unlock their creativity and build connection and a real workplace where people matter and what we do matters is so enticing, I think, to people that I think we'd be surprised how fast the world could change if we all thought, made that switch and said, hey, this paradigm's worth changing and we can do it together.
Yeah, and it can happen fast. You mentioned the children. I think the battleground is for the children because of a couple of things. One, obviously, they are our future leaders for tomorrow. So the influence we have on them today shapes tomorrow. But also, I think, like you talk about, the technology that they're growing up with and becoming very adept with and better at is empowering them to recognize, one of my favorite sayings is, not everything in the jungle kills you and eats you. Some things just attach to you and try to feed on you forever. And I think there's different business models, entities, corporate, government, not NGO, that are just pure parasites. And it's just a fact of life. Like, parasites really exist. I have a dog. I have to check it for ticks all the time. And I think, like you talk about the kids, like it's almost become a spiritual malady in a certain sense, where there's just, it's just like an ick that people feel in their heart, like something, this is not
this
how
is not
it
right.
should be. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm
yeah.
hopeful. Can we pivot? Where do
Yes.
you see the future? Because we've gone through, you mentioned the pandemic. Talking about this, not everybody agrees with how the pandemic was handled, to say it lightly. Where do you see the future of things in 5, 10 years with your crystal ball, so to speak?
And that's like a huge question. I guess my hope is that this paradigm of business shift is really going to accelerate rapidly, because I think it needs to, for the sake of the planet and for the sake of the young people, like everybody involved. There's this real opportunity for people to awaken to their real leadership potential and to create things that work, solutions that work for everyone. So that's my hope, that we basically can enlist each other and more people to work and operate like that and move towards that world. But I do think it means that some of the old structures are going to fall apart. And I think we're seeing that to a degree. And they're, I see it a little bit like you described. I don't think things are worse than they used to be. I just, because I, like I, in my life, I was both married and my current partner are both not white. And so I've experienced partner racism, I guess you would call it. Like I've been in situations where I've been refused a hotel room because of my partner. And I knew how ugly it was under the rug before it all came to the surface. And I know I don't know it like the people that are experiencing it directly, but I understood that it existed. And I think we're seeing that in all these places in the world. Like all this stuff that doesn't work is just erupting almost like little volcanoes all over the world. And the good part about it is that it's seen, so it's no more hidden. Like some of that old stuff was just under the carpet and people pretended it didn't exist. Well, you can't pretend if it's all on TV. And it seems very disheartening, but my wish is that it activates everybody who's willing to listen to ask themselves a very important question of, why am I here and what can I do to make a better world? And if everybody did that and listened to themselves, we would rapidly be able to shift things on our planet. And I think my little piece of that in my corner is to help people ask this question of, what do they need to feel and experience love? Because when people feel loved, they operate at much higher levels. And I even have if you don't mind me sharing, I have a little quiz that I give people to look at how they're like relating to the love themselves. It's at the ways of loving quiz.com. And what's good about it is it brings your awareness of like, how am I really interacting with myself and how do I support myself? And it gets you thinking about it, because if you can do a better job in caring for yourself, then you begin to treat other people better. It's, you can only go so far, right? You can't treat people that much better than you treat yourself. And that's like a very fundamental, and people might not think it relates to business, but it absolutely does.
Does 100%. We've all dealt with companies that were like, we've all done business with people that either mistreated us, or we've been employed by people that blamed us for things. Like, we've all been there. And so empathy is a powerful thing. Compassion and evidence. Jim Rohn has this quote, you can't cover your eyes and say there are no weeds in the garden. There are no weeds in the garden. That's just being naive. They take you off to the loony bin. But that said, you can shape the garden. You can pull the weeds and make this garden. Talk about interracial relationships. I've been an expat for a number of years in a lot of different countries. And I'm in an interracial relationship now, but I've seen different racism to different people. I think cultural prejudices can have validity in a sense of opposing ideas that need to discuss why they're opposing. It's almost like politics, left versus, I think we need to get away from the tribalism instead and focus more on the outcomes. And this is what you can't judge based off of a race, because people are too individualistic. But if there's a culture of people, a mindset, not to say you judge them, but that you have to accept. It's like these people that are pro-Palestine right now, but they're gay. And they're like, pro-Palestine, do you know what those people would do to you if you were in Palestine and like walking around with pride flags? That's, you can support them and they're right, your human rights, of course. But there has to be some certain thing we have to talk about and unpack. And I'm not trying to get into the details, but just, it's so much more than us versus them, good guy versus bad guy. There's so much nuance to it, I think.
Yeah. We have to be really willing to listen to each other, right? Beyond those labels, beyond the camps, the tribalism that you're talking about. And people just need to really connect with each other. Because I think you're right. If you get beyond that, then okay, sure. Maybe you think you're both going about something a better way than the other, but you probably want much more of the same thing than you.
Right. If you focus on outcomes, and there are, you need diversity and stability. So not everyone necessarily is going to see eye to eye and be on the same page. And then you have to just figure out, how do we coexist? Because
peacefully.
Most people want peace. At a certain age, I think, especially if you have kids, that's another thing. We could be here for a whole other hour, but I think the lack of having children is also part of a cultural rot, in the sense of people are caterpillars that don't get yet to become butterflies, and they lose the concept of, for posterity's sake, of legacy, like a real legacy. And understanding how, if you want to, if you're even a proof of the fractal nature of the world, just think about how people come out of people. That's just, it's the ultimate proof. People come out of people, and that's happened. And that's, my life is built on all the people that lived before me. I think about this when I drive down the road all the time. I'm able to get where I'm going in 20 minutes because a group of people spent weeks, if not months or years, in the hot sun, doing the work needed to make this smooth road for me. This technology, I didn't figure out how microphones work. I didn't build the internet. We are literally like onion layers built up on top of each other. And that's, I'm going to shut up in a second. But I think by having kids, we've never had as few kids as we have now. There's a part of our element of the zeitgeist, of our cultural kind of, our collective culture that's like forgetting these sorts of things. And anyways, for me, I felt like I had conquered life. And then I spoke three languages. I climbed Mount Fuji. I helped people make millions of dollars. I'd done everything on my bucket list. And then I had kids. And it was like, oh, I was playing checkers before, or chess. And now I'm playing 3D chess, where I'm thinking like five generations from now, looking back five generations. Yeah. You know, and that's, I think that's a really important paradigm.
Yeah, and everybody can think about the intergenerational impact of their choices, whether they have kids or not. If you can, and it really helps you get that perspective, but that's what we need to return to, because that's an ancient way. That's not something new. And there are whole cultures, Native Americans, who had that embedded in their thinking long before we came along and destroyed what they had. And we have to have respect for that ancestral wisdom that we blew by and left in the dust. It's time to reclaim a lot of that.
Yeah. A lot of people like Japan and ninja and the samurai and the Bushido, which is the way of the warrior. I lived in Japan for 3 years and they love cherry blossoms. They're these beautiful trees that explode with flowers, but they only last a week and disappear. And it symbolized to them the life of a samurai, because their lives were often short, but were so beautiful. And this is, people forget, like, societies were first, we were nomads, and then we figured out agriculture, and then we became settlers. And then it was about producing food, but then we had to have security to protect us from the bandits. And then the people who kept us safe became the king. Like the king was, the king had the army, right? That kept you safe and you paid a tax. This is where in Japan, you pay key money, it's called, when you move somewhere. Most places you pay first, last, and maybe security deposit. But in Japan, you pay first, last, deposit, and 1 or 2 months gift money of rent. So it might cost you 5 months worth of rent to go somewhere. And only three of those are like first, last, and deposit. And that's because before there would be little communities and you would have to pay the people that were going to protect your family with their lives type thing. And this is, why would they do that? Because they have that mindset that I might die, but I'm here, not even for the greater good, but I'm here to participate in society. This is my role. Yeah. And my life means nothing compared to my kids and my grandkids. And that's, and there's a knowing, and then there's a knowing in your heart. And that's why I feel like people are missing. This has been such a great talk. You've given such good knowledge, I feel like, on so many different levels, from like getting started, getting out of scarcity mindset and fear, building a culture of success that will see you through surviving ups and downs, even talk about remedying spiritual maladies here. If people want to continue the conversation, if they want to learn more, if they want to get in touch, what are some of the best ways for them to contact you?
Probably LinkedIn is a good space for them to find me, but I can pop in my info in the chat, but also if anybody's interested in more like the leadership and the coaching side, the email address I have is laura@thelovemandala.com, and they can go find me at thelovemandala.com or just find me on LinkedIn, and I will just, let me just.
So for those that are listening, you can go to the Love
Mandala.
Mandala. M-A-N-D-A-L-A. So TheLoveMandala.com. You can also look her up on LinkedIn, Laura, L-A-U-R-A, Smith, S-M-I-T-H, Biswas, B-I-S-W-A-S. Once again, that is Laura Smith, Biswas, B-I-S-W-A-S. Or go check out TheLoveMandala.com. Laura, this has been such a great and insightful interview. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience and I, knowing you have your own followers, your own companies to run, your own kids to look after. Thank you for coming and sharing with all of us so we can all do and be better.
Absolutely. Such a pleasure, Daryl, to share this time with you. And thanks for asking such great questions and building what you're building. I really respect what you're creating. I'm glad to be a little teeny part of it today in your community.
The feeling is mutual.